Hello and welcome to the Extraordinary Moms Podcast. I'm Jessica Dahlquist, and I'm so glad to be with you for another episode. I just love these podcasts because I wanted to create content that I would want to listen to. I know that I love podcasts as a mom because I love being able to multitask while I'm driving in the car, while I'm cleaning, while I'm going on a walk. I just love podcasts right now. And when I think about the things that mean the most to me as a mom, it's making connections with other moms and also hearing the stories of other moms that are in similar situations as I am, or even when they're not so similar, just feeling like, wow, there's a lot of moms going through challenging things, but they can still find the positivity in life and the joy in motherhood. And that's what this is all about, just being able to build this community where we can support one another in motherhood. There's extraordinary moms all around us, and if you're listening, you're probably one of them. Extraordinary moms aren't doing anything totally crazy and amazing. It's about the ordinary people, the ordinary moms, doing extraordinary work in the lives of their children and their families, and I want to celebrate that, and so that's why I want to bring you this podcast. If you heard episode 1 with Emily Dixon, I hope you just felt so encouraged by her positivity as her daughter Sophie was diagnosed with autism. I mean, can you believe how far her daughter has come in just a few short years? And I have no doubt she'll continue to grow and progress in just amazing ways. So I just want to thank Emily for joining us. I want to take the time at this point to remind you to go to iTunes, and if you do me a favor and subscribe to the podcast. Look up the Extraordinary Moms Podcast and click the button that says subscribe. That way, every time there's a new episode that comes out, it'll go straight to your playlist and you'll never miss an episode. If you'll also rate and review the podcast, that will help so much to help other people to find this podcast. I'm so excited about the content and I know that it could help so many moms out there if they just knew it exists. My guest today is Jackie Shakespeare. Jackie is truly an extraordinary mom. She is so inspirational, she's so positive, and she has quite the story to tell. She's going to talk about her whole family and raising all boys, just like me. But what sets Jackie apart is what her family's been through in the last few years. When her baby Mathis was 6 months old, he was diagnosed with a terminal illness. But instead of letting that devastating news get the family down, they decided to rally around baby Mathis and really live, really celebrate the life, whatever life he had left on this earth. And they truly did. So I really hope you enjoy this episode. Jackie and I ended up having so much to cover that our interview got really long. And so I decided to break up the interview into two sections. So I really hope you enjoyed this interview, part one, and then definitely follow up and download part two as well. And there's just so much she has to cover and so much she has to share. I just wanted to make sure you got the whole story and weren't left wanting more. So enjoy part one and part two of this episode. I do want to recommend you grab your tissues because this is a really emotional topic, but I think you'll find a lot of hope and a lot of inspiration from Jackie's words. So let's get to the show. So let me give a little background on you. Jackie and I met when we were in Provo, Utah, and we were newly married, but the funny part is that Pete and I were newly married. We were like 6 months into our marriage, and we had a lot of friends in the same kind of stage of life as us, being a college town, and so you'd ask, oh, how long have you been married? And be a year, and oh, how about you? A year and a half, 6 months, da-da-da, and then we asked you, and you're like, oh, 5 years. I'm like, 5 years? That's forever. And I just couldn't even fathom 5 years of marriage. That just sounded like the longest you could ever be married, ever. But now we've both been married for much longer than 5 years. I've been married almost 9. How about you?
Oh, heavens. It will be 13 this year.
See, that's more than 5, and that sounds even more impressive. So you married your high school sweetheart, Dewan.
I did.
Was it love at first sight?
We grew up together. Okay. And so I had known him and known of him since about the third or fourth grade. And he moved away for a little while and then came back at the end of junior high. and we didn't really start dating. We started dating in 10th grade.
Okay.
But he came back in junior high, and I was a TA for his class in 8th grade. And come to find out, he had had a crush on me since the 8th grade.
Oh.
And so he, but yes, once we started dating, I knew that, I didn't know that exactly he was the one, but I knew he was really, really important and really special. I remember the first night after we were going out, we talked on the phone until 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning.
Wow.
And it was just like, it never lulled. It was just completely comfortable and it just flowed really easily. And that's just been the way it has been ever since. Like, we're both completely different personality types.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a lot more talkative and more, proactive and planning. I'm constantly planning. And he is more of the, still waters run deep. Like, just because he's quiet doesn't mean nothing's going on. Like, he's analyzing, he's scanning situations, he's very observant. And so it kind of
balances each other out
completely. And the kind of relationship that we've had is that, you know, I kind of verbally express what he's feeling and we just kind of confirm what each other is kind of going on. And so it's really cool. We've been on the same wavelength for a long, long time.
That is so neat to have that history. Pete and I also met in high school and have kind of a similar history. We didn't date in high school, but, you know, it's just so fun to go back that far and,
yes,
you know each other's families and be from the same place. And it's just, it's so neat to have that history. That's awesome.
Yes, I like it.
That's great. The other thing that really stands out in my mind about you is once you did have your first baby while we were still living in Provo, and Mannix was, I don't even know how old he was, a few months old, but we were at a cooking class for church, and I was holding Mannix, and they were going to say the prayer, and so I'm holding him and bouncing him, and he's just the cutest, the absolute cutest. And then all of a sudden, it's just silent. Everyone's praying. And then I hear, bleh. And he vomits all over my jacket. And that kind of ruined the mood. But, you know, good thing he's cute, right?
That, right. And I don't even remember this.
Oh, that's so funny. Well, it's, I'm over it. I'm clearly over it. Because I do.
I'm glad we can still be friends.
Yes, we can definitely still be friends. Well, that's awesome. Well, I'm just so excited to have you on the episode today because you just have such a powerful story to tell. So why don't you go ahead and give a little background. You gave us a little background with you and your husband, but tell me about your upbringing and your education and give me a little of that stuff.
I had kind of a tumultuous early childhood. I had gone back and forth from mom to dad to different things. My parents both had addiction problems, and so eventually I chose to live with my grandparents.
Oh.
A particular situation occurred, and I called my grandma, and I said, please come and get me. I'm done.
Wow.
And
how old were you?
I was 8 years old.
No way.
Uh-huh. Wow. 8 years old. And I called and said, I'm done. Come and get me.
Wow.
And so she came, and I'm really appreciative for that because she really put her and her daughter's relationship on the line.
Wow.
For my sake. And I think that that was a huge pivotal point for me, because there I gained the security, the stability, the spirituality, the structure that I needed and that I craved, I think.
Wow.
And so I just knew that it was something that I needed and wanted. And there were times where, you know, I think I was there for a couple of weeks, and this was probably in September, October at the time. And my grandpa said, well, if she's going to stay here an extended period of time, we've got to get her in school. And so as soon as I knew that I was enrolled in school, I knew that I would be okay, and then I knew that I would stay.
Right, right.
But my grandparents were the rock of my upbringing, and I am really grateful that they were available and that they were willing.
Absolutely. That's a big thing to take on.
Exactly. And especially when you're already done raising your children.
Right.
And you never expected it, but here I am, and yep, I will do it.
Awesome. Wow.
Yeah.
So that's great. That was a good backup plan. I mean, a lot of 8-year-olds might not have their grandparents just ready to take them on, but
exactly.
So you lived there your whole upbringing from 8 on?
Mm-hmm. From eight years old on, mm-hmm. I lived with them, and I was raised by a, she called herself a homemaker, but she knew a little about everything, and she would read books, and she would take classes for different things. I remember I was in college, and I think even after I was married, she was at the community college taking a floral arranging class.
Wow.
And before that, she was at the community college taking, like, sociology, and she loved people and studying people. And then you marry that with a very A-type personality attorney in my grandfather. So
it's kind of like you and Dwan, you know, right. Like she had that, you know, more creative yes. type side, inquisitive, and then he's the practical, logical.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I was able to glean that from both of them and to kind of, you know, in my younger years, I think I was more a tight personality and more high strung. But I think through being married that Dwan has calmed me down, or that I have learned from him to be more patient, to sit back and to watch and to not be so eager about things sometimes.
Yeah.
There's a time and place, but not always do you need to.
Yeah, I think when you get married, you can never expect your spouse to change. Like, you shouldn't go into it wanting them to change anything. But I think it's so neat to watch your partner evolve and watch yourself evolve as you just appreciate what that other person brings out in you and what you can learn from them. And, I mean, that's the beauty of marriage.
Right, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I truly believe that.
So then you went to college. And where did you go and what did you study?
I went to Brigham Young University in Provo. Mm-hmm. I studied visual arts, and as I was finishing, we decided that we would be married. He asked me to marry him, and we were engaged, and I tried to convince him to come up to BYU and go to school, and he said, nope, I want to go to school in California, so I moved home, and we were married after graduation. And to kind of show you a little bit of my personality back then, I graduated with my bachelor's degree in 2.5 calendar years.
Boom. Grandma was proud, I'm sure.
Which is insanity, right?
Yes.
But I took 23 credits, a couple of different semesters. I did everything that I needed to do. And so when I had a goal set in mind, like there, I did everything in my power to achieve that. And so I was like, well, I'm just going to go ahead and finish. So then, because part of Dwan's mom's wish was that one of us would graduate from college before we got married.
Which is usually practical.
Right.
You know, somebody earning money.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, well, he sure as heck isn't going to be graduated from college by then, so may as well be me. So we were married and lived at home for a year in Southern California, and about 8 or 9 months in, he said, you know, I think I need to go up to BYU and go to school. And I said, okay. And so back I went.
Mm-hmm.
And we lived there. And so I kind of had this, like I told you, I'm a planner.
Mm-hmm.
And I have kind of, I've always had a plan. I think that comes from having parents with addictions, is that there's a lot of instability. And so you need to control what you can. And I think that that's where more of the A-type personality came. And I, in fact, just learned that most recently from reading kind of I believe it was a blog post that said, like, 5 or 10 things that about, like, a child of an addict, you know, behaviors or habits. And I went through each of these different things, and it was so right on.
Really?
And it was very indicative of what my, you know, behavior or personality had been like. And so I had this 5-year plan, and I didn't want to have a baby right away because I didn't want to have a baby and in school and not be able to work. And
right.
then where would we pay? You know what I mean? All these logistics.
Right.
And so I figured, for me, I would want to get pregnant in his 3rd year of school, so then we could have the baby, and then he could be done. And it worked out just like that.
Perfect.
He Mannix was born. Well, it didn't quite just work out like that. We actually tried to get pregnant after our third year of marriage, and we miscarried. And my grandma had miscarried, and so she had already passed away by then, and she was the only person that I had ever known that had said that they had a miscarriage.
Oh,
like,
wow.
It was kind of this taboo type thing to talk about, and I wonder if it's almost because we as women kind of think of our reproductive purpose is to have babies. And so if we can't have babies, then we're obviously failing at this.
Mm.
And we don't want to share our failures, at least up until probably, I would say, you know, the last 15 years, I think we've become more outspoken and more willing to share our experiences. And I happen to be O negative blood type.
Mm.
And the negative Rh factor was quite significant because when you miscarry and you're negative Rh factor, you have to go in and get a Rogam shot, which is basically to prevent Rh sensitivity in the next baby. So I get my Rogam shot, and we waited, I think they told us to wait a full cycle and then to try again. And we did. And we miscarried again.
Oh, man.
And so here I am on this path of miscarriage. And of course, now I can't just miscarry at home. And I shouldn't say just miscarry.
Right,
but
right.
In relativity to the story, I can't sit here and miscarry and go through the process and grieve and heal on my own. And at home, I have to go to the hospital and get yet another Rogam shot.
Wow.
And so it was after then that we went to a specific doctor that I had received a referral from someone else. And so then he said, okay, well, when you get pregnant next time, we will put you on progesterone and we'll have you on that until the 14th week. And then we'll take you off. And at that point, the placenta takes over. Basically, the progesterone will feed the baby until the placenta takes over. And that's at about 14 weeks. So I said, okay. I'm like, me as a planner, I'm like, we have a plan. This is fantastic.
This is my kind of doctor. Yeah.
Right? I can get on board.
You're right.
So I got pregnant and called him right away. He called in a prescription and we were in. And I got on this progesterone and everything was great. And had a really good pregnancy. That being said, quotient for a good pregnancy is not being sick more than 22 times a day on some days.
Oh, man.
I was really, really sick throughout my whole pregnancies. There were certain ones where I could eat a certain thing, but it would only be that. And with him, it happened to be pineapple.
Does he like pineapple now?
Loves it.
Oh, there you go. Mm-hmm. My mom ate chili dogs. But I can't say there's a strong correlation there. But
that's a good one. And so everything was good. And I remember I would just come to the appointments with him just with lists and lists and lists. I'm also a list maker, can you tell?
Uh-huh.
With these lists of questions. And I remember one time I just asked him, I said, what's it like to see a baby be born? And he got a tear in his eye and he said, no matter how many babies that I have delivered, it never gets old. Oh. It's always the most amazing experience that I've ever experienced to deliver a brand new baby and a brand new life.
Wow.
And I remember towards one of the latter ultrasounds that he was doing, and he was in a small office, so he did his own ultrasounds. And we sat there, and he knew that I was apprehensive, that we had miscarried twice, but he said he pointed the ultrasound probe to Mannix's head, and he says, do you see that brain in there? And I said, yeah. He said, my husband and I kind of looked at each other like, okay, is something wrong? He says, I want you to look really hard at that brain, because when he's 16, you're going to say to him, now I know you have a brain in your head because I've seen it. And he was just got done having a teenager, his last teenager at home. And so I think that was definitely coming from
personal experience. Yes.
Yeah. He he was just darling. I loved him. And so delivery, you know, was great. He was born. Luckily I did not experience any postpartum depression with him. Things were great, and he just grew and developed, and he was right on track with everything, if not ahead, and everything was good.
And he didn't like lullabies or cartoons at an early age, but he did like what?
He did like football, and still does, I'll have you know. I remember one time, we had to negotiate with him that he would wear this football helmet everywhere, and it was a costume football helmet. He would wear it literally everywhere. I remember people would think that he had one of those orthopedic helmets on, and they would come to tell me, like, oh, the helmet's loose, but then they would realize it was this costume helmet.
Oh, my goodness.
And his first, you know, everything was football, everything was football. And so he was a riot. He was such a funny, funny little kid. But, yeah, so this one day we had to negotiate with them that instead of taking his football helmet to church, that he could take a Sports Illustrated. It was the Super Bowl edition. And the whole time in church, he's like, football player, coach, you know, and all these different things. This child is such a crack-up, and I think that he was probably close to 3 by that time.
That is young to have that great of a passion.
Oh, yes. I remember my husband was doing sports medicine, and he was doing a rotation at one of the local high schools, and Mannix was 6 months old. And we would sit on the front row and watch the football game. And I kid you not, if somebody walked by and kind of walked in between his line of view of the football field and him, he would fuss and and just could not stand it. So I, being the crazy lady, I have to get up and say, excuse me, could you please step to the side? My baby can't see
the football game.
And people would look at me like this lady had lost her marbles.
Oh, my goodness.
But sure enough, as soon as they would move out of his line of sight, he would
calm.
Be completely fine.
My goodness.
And he still, to this day, like, he understands it. Like, he watched some of my husband's old football film, and I say film, but it's VHS tapes. Yeah.
Really clear resolution.
Right, yes.
Like, is that Dad?
Right, like, I don't even know what that is.
Yeah.
And he sat down, and he's 7 years old, and he sat down and wrote what these plays were.
Oh,
and
my goodness.
I asked my husband later, and I said, is that really? You know, he says, yeah. He says, that's really basically what those plays are. So there's something in him that just...
Wow, that is neat. It. Well, I wonder what he's going to do someday. He's going to be something. Watch out for Mannix Shakespeare someday playing in the NFL. Coming to
an
awesome college near you. That's awesome. Yeah.
And then we decided that when we, I think Mannix was about 2, we decided to have, my husband was in grad school by that point. We decided to get pregnant with another baby. And I said, you know what, let's try it without progesterone just to see if this really is what it is. And so we tried and with no progesterone, and I miscarried. And I thought, okay, well, this is it again. And so I went in for my regular, you know, routine Rogam shot. And then something happened, and I was still on progesterone, I was on progesterone ahead of time, and I miscarried again. But I was never getting these positive pregnancy tests. But I knew my body was pregnant. And I remember the second time, so this is my 4th miscarriage, the second time before our second child, I remember leaving the hospital and being really angry. Being really angry with God, because here I am wanting this child to come and being willing to take responsibility and take care for this life, but yet being what I felt like was robbed of the opportunity.
Wow.
And I just broke down on the way home, and I was just like, you know, I don't know what it is. And, you know, come to find out, there was a reason why all of that was happening. And so we, you know, waited the cycle and then ended up getting pregnant with our second baby, Mason. And he, in utero, he was stronger and more active. And in life, he is passionate. I call him my passionate child.
Right.
So when he was 3 months old, my husband graduated from grad school, and we moved to St. George. And then when, let's see, Mason would have been about 10 months old, and I found out that I was pregnant. And I was like, what in the heck is going on? Like, this is impossible. Kind of like a denial.
Right.
What? Like, I can't get pregnant on my own. Like, this, how did I get a positive pregnancy test?
Right.
Like,
I've never seen this before.
Right?
Yes.
Like, disputing, like, these medical claims. Like, well, the pregnancy test says it's positive. And I was like, well, it's gotta be. It's gotta
right.
be a false
Something's
positive.
Wrong.
Because
yeah.
surely this isn't right. And then I'm going into, okay, there's no way that this baby is still here. Like, this baby's gotta be miscarrying because I'm not on progesterone. I'm not doing anything. So I find, I'm in a new place where I have to find a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
So I find this doctor, and sure enough, they do the early ultrasound, and this little gummy bear is sticking, and
oh,
the heart is beating,
goodness.
And everything is going on, and I was like, oh my word, like, what?
This is happening, and I have a 10-month-old.
And I have a 10-month-old, and let me tell you, I cried.
I bet.
Definitely cried. I was like, what, my life has just come undone. Like, I was pretty sure that that was the lowest point in my life.
Oh, my gosh.
Because here I am with a 3-year-old, and my 3-year-old at the time had a stutter. My, you know, now 10-month-old, and now I'm pregnant. And I was just like, oh, my Lanta, if I get through this, it is going to be a miracle.
Miracle. And then you
and
found
then,
out he was a boy.
And then
another boy.
Boy. And I was like, perfect. And I was actually super excited that he was a boy because I thought, I have all boys. I have everything ready.
Uh-huh.
In my planner ways, like, I've got all the clothes.
Yep.
I don't need to buy anything. And his pregnancy was a little bit different. He didn't quite move as much. And when he did move, it was kind of softer.
Hmm.
And he turned quite a bit in utero and became breech towards the end. And so I was admitted to the hospital for a brief time so they could do what's called a transverse, I believe, where they move the baby back into position.
Like they shift
so basically
on
they
the outside?
Flip them.
Oh, boy.
Right.
Oh, boy.
So they flip the baby in utero. But they have to have you admitted because they don't know if it's going to put you into labor or
okay.
if it's going to break your water or whatnot.
That so sounds very painful.
It actually was, yes.
Okay,
painful.
Okay.
Because here he is, he's got one arm pushing on one pole of the baby, like the feet or so. Well, really, the baby's, it's got to be a bum or head.
Yeah.
With the way a baby is positioned in the womb. And so he's got one hand, like, anchoring one pole of the baby, and then the other hand is pushing with all of his might and trying to pivot this baby around.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes.
Oh,
so the baby was, the baby was transverse. And so
okay.
at one point they did the ultrasound and he was breech. And then when I was admitted to the hospital, he was transverse and they tried to flip him. And it was successful. And they did flip him.
Wow.
And so I left the hospital. Everything was great. I go to my next appointment the next week later and he's flipped breech again.
Hmm.
And they're like, oh my gosh, what are we going to do?
Yeah.
So then the doctor, so then I go to my next appointment and he's head down and the doctor decides, okay, I've got to take this opportunity. This baby has been breached twice, has been transverse. And so I need to take this baby and reduce the risk of a lot of complications and take him now.
Wow.
And so, we were totally on board.
So how many weeks along were you?
Let's see. I think he was 8 days early.
Okay. So you were close.
I was rather close. It was in that window and he was my third child. And so, you know, at this point,
mm-hmm.
and he was going to be my last at that point too.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like, you know, do what you have to do to make sure baby's healthy, mom's
right.
healthy. I trust you.
Right.
And so he was born, fantastic Apgar scores. He scored a 9 and a 9.
And his name is Mathis.
Mm-hmm. This is Mathis who was born. And he was born September 8th. 2012. And it happened to be 2 days before my husband's birthday. And so we got to take him home on my husband's birthday. Aww. And I was like, what a special birthday gift.
Right.
And we named him Mathis Mateo. And I have to tell you, I got the name Mathis from watching Say Yes to the Dress, Atlanta.
Mom, tell me again why you named him Mathis.
Right?
Well, let me tell you that special story.
Stephanie Plum. I watched Say Yes to the Dress.
Oh, cute.
And one of the groomsmen was named Mathis. And I thought, oh, I like that.
And we did going with all M names.
All of our boys to be M's. But it was just kind of an evolution. And then this third boy, I was like, well, I can't have him have a different name.
Yeah.
He has to be an M name, too. Otherwise, he's going to feel like chopped liver.
Right.
So here he is, he's born, everything's going good, he's, you know, eating like a champ, nursing, and everything's going well. And then I noticed that normally I would sit my babies, I had the same couch for all of these babies, and so I'd have kind of a good frame of reference to judge, and I went to sit him up in kind of the little crook of the cushion, and he would just flop over, and I thought, well, this is strange. And you know how it is when you have a new baby. Like, you forget what happened when you had the
baby. It's like you've never had a baby before.
Yes.
It's how, like it's just experience. Amnesia. The delivery's amnesia. The first 6 weeks, you forget everything. Yeah.
Yes, yes. So I'm in that, you know, and fatigue stupor.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, maybe it's just him. And I'd learned by then not to compare kids because,
yeah.
You know, they were just different. And so I thought, well, okay. And so then I would, you know, put him back up, and he would still do that. And then we went up north for a business thing for my husband. We tagged along with him, and we took pictures, family pictures, at this studio. And at that point, he was, I believe he was 6 weeks old. And the photographer, she was trying to get this single portrait of Mathis. And the photographer says, how old is he? And I said, 6 weeks. And she says, oh, that's weird, because usually a six-week-old will hold their head up for at least a few seconds by themselves. And I thought, oh, no, somebody else.
You too?
Is starting to notice. And I thought, oh, like, now it's not just me, like, wondering, because you know how us mothers think.
Right.
Like, we're, not that we pick our children apart, but that we're hypersensitive.
Oh, absolutely.
Anything. And we're just constantly monitoring. We're mother hens.
Yes.
And so 2 weeks later, we go to his 8-week checkup, and I, you know, talked to the doctor, and she did her full physical exam, and he was very floppy and was just kind of like a rag doll, like where he would hold him and just his limbs would just flop. And she would try to stand him up, and she would try to stimulate his feet and his legs, and it just wouldn't, nothing would work, and he was just, you know, slumped over. And she would try to put him on his tummy, and he would just remain face down, like would not move his head. And so she kind of, after some thinking, and, you know, she decided that, she says, you know what, I would diagnose him with a case of hypotonia.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I didn't know what that meant, but basically it was low muscle tone.
Okay.
And so here we were. We had this label of low muscle tone. So I went home and Googled low muscle tone, which is a terrible idea. Like, if you ever come home from a doctor's office, like, do not Google. And her name happened to start with a G. And she, at one point in our treatments, she says, you know, don't go to Google. Talk to Dr. G. Don't go to
I will be your Google. Yeah.
She's like, I'll be your G. And so we left there. And of course, when you're told something like that, you have no questions in your mind.
Right.
You're just like, okay.
You're just not prepared.
Like sticker shock.
Yeah.
Right. And then you're in this sticker shock point where you have no idea what you're doing. And you're just like, okay, this is new information and I have not processed it yet. And so we went home and I Googled it, and it led to all sorts of things. And a lot of different diseases actually are correlated with hypotonia. And so I ran the gamut from spinal bifida to Down syndrome to other different things. And I thought, well, this is kind of ridiculous. So let's just, you know, concentrate on hypotonia. Let's try to get his muscles stronger.
Okay.
And so we found out about this early intervention program for here locally, and we had him in physical therapy since he was 10 weeks old.
Mm.
And it was a physical therapist that would come to the house, and she would weekly, and we would work with her, and then she would teach us different techniques or play activities for him. And each week I was very efficient, and I would copy her notes and fax them to the doctor to make sure she was kept up on it. And then we went to his 3-month visit, excuse me, 4-month visit. And at that point, or around 3 months, when he was about 3 months old, I was going through severe postpartum depression. And normally when you are asked if you're having postpartum depression, they say, you know, do you feel like you're going to hurt yourself? Do you feel like you're going to hurt your baby? Do you feel, you know, all of these different things?
Right.
And for me, it was never any of that. I never felt like I was going to hurt any of my kids or myself, but I had this extreme need to leave. And my husband needed to find somebody else that could better raise my children than I could.
Wow.
And wow. By all normal standards, there's no way in life that's ever happening. Like, I am a mother bear through and through.
Absolutely, like,
you're
right.
You're not separating me from my children.
These are not your typical thoughts, right?
Right, right. But somehow I could compartmentalize and realize that this was craziness, that this was not normal, that this was not me. And so I would talk to my husband, and, you know, I would cry a lot, and I kind of associated the crying to be, you know, Mathis related and his, you know, not reaching any milestones at all, no matter how much work we had gone through.
Right.
And so I kind of equated it to that. And so we went to our 4-month checkup, and I was a hot mess, like the ugly cry the whole time through. And she was like, just focus on the positive and that. And so she knew that I was had postpartum.
Mm-hmm.
She saw it as a completely casebook clinical, you know,
right.
You know, illustration of postpartum. So I, through my husband's help and through, you know, being able to kind of compartmentalize, I called my doctor and went on an antidepressant, and that was a huge blessing. Like, normally they say that it takes a couple of weeks to kick in. For me, it was a dose and a half. Like, and
wow.
I already felt a difference.
Wow, that is amazing. And I mean, there's just
amazing.
Such demands on moms. And not only do you have this baby you're dealing with, but also the other two
right.
children who, you know, are not completely independent. And so, I mean, you're just being pulled in so many directions, and your
mm-hmm.
hormones are wackadoo anyways from, you know, after
right.
delivery. But then
oh, yeah.
to have,
on the down, on
yeah.
the downhill of those pregnancy hormones
yes.
is treacherous territory.
But I mean, the relief you can find when you say, okay, this is not right. There's something wrong. You can
right.
seek help. And there is help. And so.
And to have the courage to ask for help.
Absolutely. There's
because
no shame in that.
In some circles, we have this shame or this this undue negativity
mm-hmm.
about antidepressants.
Yeah.
And I think that they are hugely underutilized by people that really need them.
Right.
Because of this taboo label on them.
That's,
and I think
yeah.
that for some people, they are over-prescribed, you know, but I'm not the one to judge.
Right.
But so I was on the antidepressant and things were going really well. And then we had been doing physical therapy still. My husband was wanting to do some experimental therapies with him. He does this electronic stimulation through some of his patients and therapies and knows that it works and knows that it helps with muscle memory. And so he's thinking, you know, I know that this works and I deal with this on a daily basis with my patients. And why can't I use this to help my son?
Yeah.
And so he starts to research it and with the physical therapist. And so he starts, you know, just trying everything he can. Like, we're thinking out of the box. We're like, our physical therapist at one point was lying in bed awake in the middle of the night, trying to figure out how to, you know, put bells on Mathis's
wow.
feet so he could have that stimulation of when you move your feet, you hear the bells. So it was just this constant, you know, puzzle current that was just what we did. Like, that's what our job was. And so then we went in for his 6 month checkup. And he had been on the physical therapy since he was 10 weeks old. And we walked in, or she walked in the door, and she kind of, you know, did kind of like a seeing how we were doing and where we were with it. And the whole time she had asked us before, you know, do you want to do tests? Do you want to know why? And I said, I don't need to know why. I just want to get him better.
Right.
I don't need to know what is causing it. I just want to help him get the stronger muscles.
Yeah.
And so she walked in the room, and after we're talking and that, and she says, I want you to see a geneticist. And I said, okay. And I think that she knew at that point that I had my postpartum back on track, and she knew that I could handle the diagnosis at that point. I think she knew that despite me still crying in her office, and by the way, I had never cried in the doctor's office with any of my other children until Mathis, and I cried in every doctor's office. And so she knew then that we needed to know. And at that point, his spinal, he was diagnosed with spinal muscular atrophy through going to a geneticist and, you know, figuring some things out.
Had you ever heard that term before?
Never in my life. Spinal muscular atrophy, okay. Or SMA.
Okay.
And it was one of the three things that the geneticist wanted to test for. And so, of course, me and my Google went back to Google that night after we got home from the geneticist, and Dwan went to work, and I hopped on Google, and I started to look at the symptoms of each of these three diseases that she gave me, and I looked up Prader-Willi, and it didn't coincide with what we were experiencing. I looked up Pompe, and, you know, it didn't really make a lot of sense, and then I looked up this SMA, and it was like looking into a mirror. Like, and these were just these textbook Mayo Clinic case study, you know, definitions of what a disease is. And it was exactly what it was. I knew in my heart that that's what it was.
What was that moment like, reading those symptoms?
It was kind of this jubilation, because it was like, this is exactly what it is. Like, somebody else knows what it is.
Like, unlocking the secret. Yeah.
Yes, yes. But also, as I began to read, the part that just, you know, literally ripped out my bottom was the part where it said, most cases do not live past 2 years old. And I just thought, what?
My baby? My Mathis? Yeah.
Right. And so I still had no real, you know, frame. And so I'm holding out hope that we're going to get these tests done, and it's going to be this Pompe. And so they took some blood that day, and I had to take them back for an EKG and another more blood drawn the next day. But my husband came home from work, and he didn't know that I had been researching all this. And he came home, and I had him read about this SMA, and I said, this is it. And he read it and just started crying, because he knew that's what it was, too.
Yeah.
And so for me, as a mother, I didn't need a DNA test that told me that's what he had.
Yeah.
I knew that that's what he had, because that's what I had lived. It was like reading, you know, my exact mirror.
Yeah, your description,
last 6 months.
Yeah.
Right? And so I go the next morning, and I take him to the cardiology department to get an EKG, and they want to sedate him. And I said, you are not sedating this baby. He doesn't move. Like, this is why we are here.
If he has anything going for him, it's the fact that he's not going to be your wiggle worm.
I promise, he will yank the probe out of your hand because he can't do it. And so, you know, policy is policy, so I had to go and get permission from the doctor, the pediatrician, that he not be intubated. Not intubated, but sedated.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm sitting in the waiting room, or not the waiting room, but the lobby kind of waiting room.
Mm-hmm.
And wait, because the doctor was running late, and Dwan calls. The geneticist called him And she said, well, I'm still holding out hope, but I think it's SMA. And so at that point, it was, the bottom had fallen out.
Right.
And we kept, or we found out this SMA is a autosomal recessive, which that is a big word for two recessive genes coming together. And so basically, it's kind of like blue eyes. Each parent has to be a carrier of blue eyes in order for the baby to have blue eyes.
Right.
And if you remember your Punnett square chart with, in, you know, from biology,
yeah,
you have a 25% chance of this of blue eyes, and, you know, it's a different percentage for eye color, but
right,
with this SMA, a 50% chance that they're a carrier.
Okay.
A 25% chance that they are not a carrier, and a 25% chance that they're affected.
Okay.
So this is in each and every pregnancy. So you roll the dice each time.
Wow.
And so it's autosomal recessive, and it actually affects, it's kind of a big word, but when you break it down, it makes a lot more sense. It affects the survival motor neuron gene. And there are two different genes in there. There's the SMN1 gene. And basically, in a healthy person, that gene produces protein called a survival motor neuron protein, or SMN.
Okay.
And then it's used for, you know, the function of your nerves and your muscles communicating together. And so without those functioning properly, they eventually die out, and that's the atrophy part.
Oh.
And that leads to debilitating muscle weakness, and a lot of times it's... they lose their suck and their swallow, their ability to breathe, and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so in people that have SMA, most are, I should say, in the average population, someone that's not affected will have two copies of this SMN1 gene. And then people that are carriers will have one faulty copy, or one mutated one, and one that works.
Hmm.
And so then carriers, and so they would be carriers like my husband and I. So
okay,
we each have a gene that works for us, but then we're also carrying a
faulty one. Oh, interesting.
That's mutated, right. And so that's what makes it autosomal recessive, because you have to have both parents passing on this mutated gene.
Is this very common?
Well, they are claiming that it's 1 in 50 people are carriers.
Really?
When Mathis was alive, it was 1 in 40, but I think they've updated their research.
Interesting. That's a lot.
Yes.
That's,
and so then there's also this SMN2 gene, because there's four different types of SMA. There's type 1, which Mathis had, and that is, you know, very, it's the genetic, number one genetic killer of infants.
Really?
And, uh-huh. And it, then there's a second SMA type 2, and that is diagnosed, and SMA1, which he had, is diagnosed early, like within the first 6 months.
Oh.
And then type 2, they are typically called sitters. Not always. There's a lot of overlap between different types because it just depends on the person.
Mm-hmm.
They're typically called sitters because they will reach the milestone of sitting, but then they won't go further than sitting.
Oh.
So, like, type 1 will never lift their head up by themselves. Type 2 will never go past sitting.
Okay.
Type 3 is usually more of the older onset, and they'll usually diagnosed in adolescence to adulthood, and they, you know, and so on. And so it's just each number delays the onset of the symptoms.
Okay.
An interesting thing with Mathis is he had a double deletion.
Huh.
So he had no SMN1, and he had no SMN2 gene.
Wow.
It was of particular interest to the geneticists, and they actually asked for his DNA to be studied because they hadn't had something like that
Interesting.
For probably a long time.
Wow.
Is at least that's what the, you know, the lab and,
yeah,
and the geneticist told us. And so So that day that my husband called me from the hospital, or when I was in the waiting room,
right,
after he had talked to the geneticist, that was the point where everything fell out. I wrote a blog, and if you don't mind, I think I'll read a little section from that part.
Yeah, please do.
Because I think it kind of will help to illustrate a bit what exactly was kind of going on at that time.
Well, and I'll say that I had, my Austin was just a few months older than Mathis, and so I remember being up in the middle of the night feeding him, and I was on my phone, and I saw I had an email, and I clicked on it, it was from you, and that's the email where you told us about Mathis and mm-hmm. about the diagnosis. And I'm sitting there holding my baby that is just months older than him. And I just started weeping. I mean, I could literally feel your pain. And I understood, like, you are holding your precious baby. And knowing what you are going to talk about, what you know now for your baby and the prognosis. Oh, Jackie,
right.
as a heart.
Mother, you automatically put yourself in
absolutely.
Another mother's
absolutely.
Shoes.
Yeah. Okay. So go ahead and read it.
It says, I wrote, as I sat in the waiting room, I got a call from my husband. The geneticist called and said she was holding out hope, but all the signs pointed to SMA type 1. My world fell apart. We cried and cried and cried. He didn't have a life expectancy of more than 2. With this, what am I going to do? We tried so hard for so long to have these children. Now another one is going to be taken from us. Why? How am I going to watch my baby die? How am I going to watch my baby die? I needed to talk to my doctor. I needed to know what she thought. I wasn't going to leave there without talking to her. I trust her. I love her and respect her. I needed her. The sweet ladies at the doctor's office brought me water. They offered to put me in an exam room several times. I refused to leave the waiting room because I didn't want to be alone. I didn't want to be left in a tiny room with my baby and all of my thoughts. I needed the distraction of other people walking around and playing and kids playing. The doctor was running late, and the sweet lady asked me to come back to wait in the exam room. She would wait with me. She wouldn't leave me alone. She sat with me as I told her what came about in the last 18 hours. Then my pediatrician walked in the door. She looked at me and immediately hugged me and began to cry. I sobbed. I managed to ask her if this was what she thought it was. She said yes. I wailed in agony. My absolute bottom fell out. This was the worst day of my entire life. I hadn't felt like pain like this since my granny passed away several years prior, and even that can't compare to this. Then I asked her how long she knew. She said, I suspected it for a while, but I didn't think you were ready to hear it last time. You needed to get well first before you could handle this. I'm humbled and grateful for her foresight and knowledge to wait until she felt I was ready. If she sent us to the geneticist after his four-month checkup, when I was in the depths of postpartum depression, I would have likely been in the fetal position in the corner and likely suicidal. How was I supposed to get through this? Again, how am I supposed to watch my baby die? How can I be a mother and not be able to do anything to save his life? I'm supposed to protect him and to do everything in my superhuman mama bear ways to protect and defend, but I can't change DNA. We sat and talked. There were 4 women in the room, including me. They promised to be with me every step of the way. I began to mourn. I wondered where we would bury him. How would we plan it? Who do you call first? Should I learn infant CPR? Do we need to continue physical therapy? How would we tell Mannix? We can't explain it to Mason, but how do I watch him look around for his baby and ask, baby, 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 and him not be able to find his baby brother? I let myself go to the deepest, darkest bottom. I cried so much that I couldn't cry anymore. I called my friend who lost a baby at birth due to a different genetic tragedy. She gave me exactly what I needed. She was the answer to my deepest, most earnest prayer. She said the diagnosis is the hardest part. You will go through a full mourning, and then you will live life and enjoy it. You will be okay. You will experience the physical death, but you will be okay. Mm-hmm. It was right then and there that I knew she spoke to my mind, and the Spirit of the Lord spoke to my soul. He testified to me that what she said was true. It was that moment that I knew I would be okay. I knew I would get through this. I went to sleep that night and told myself that tomorrow we will live. Ugh. Mathis will live life to the fullest.
Are you crying? I know I am. Isn't Jackie just so amazing? Her journey up to this point has been uncertain, but now that she has this diagnosis, she has a choice about how she's going to move forward and how she's going to allow Mathis to live. No matter how many days left he has on this earth, she is going to let him live, and she is going to ensure that her whole family embraces life every single day that they have with him. So we keep talking, so I'm going to go ahead and cut it off now. And in part two, Jackie will tell how she goes forward from that next day on and how she embraces life as for Mathis and as a family. And it is just so inspirational. So I hope you'll join us. Please log on to iTunes and click subscribe. And that way you can easily access any new episodes that come about, including part two of my interview with Jackie. Thanks so much for joining me today. I hope you've enjoyed this interview so far. And I hope you'll join me for Jackie part two for the next episode. Thanks and have a great day.